Kick-Ass Vets, sharing tips to help empower you to take control of your career.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us at Kick-Ass Vets. Today, we are very, very fortunate to have the lovely Dr. Jessica with us here today, and she's going to share her story on how she came to be a vet, her experience in the vet world, and, you know, unfortunately, she has left clinical practice because of her experiences, and she wants to share them with you so that if you're maybe in her same position, you know, the choices she made, what she liked about her choices, didn't like about her choices, that kind of stuff, and just general conversation about the vet industry. So thank you so much for coming. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Thank you for having me.
No worries, and I'll let you just tell us a little bit about what your vet history is.
So I'm originally from the United States, originally from New Jersey, and I worked as a vet nurse before going to vet school in the States. So in the States, for those who don't know, it's a four-year undergrad bachelor's degree and then a four-year graduate degree. And I did vet nursing, and then I got into a small animal science degree in the States. And I really hated it, so I dropped out after, I think I did one semester, or half a year, and kept my vet nursing job, and I guess just through the grapevine of searching around on Google, found the University of Sydney in Australia, and found that they offered a vet degree that I could do right away. I didn't have to do the Bachelor's of Small Animal Science, I could go straight to vet school. And when I looked at the cost, even the international pricing was a lot cheaper than what it costs to do the same thing in the States. So I thought, I can save some money, I can save some time, I'll just jump right in and do it. And I applied, and I didn't tell anyone in my family. I just sort of jumped in and did it and got in somehow. did DNA in Sydney, really enjoyed it. Vet school was probably some of like the best times of my life. Really enjoyed vet school. And getting out into, I guess, working as a vet in Australia just did not meet my expectations at all. I found it really difficult on graduating finding a position. A lot of my friends didn't have a lot of issues finding positions, but I did, and I think that was really because I wasn't a permanent resident at that time yet. I was still sort of like an international, and no one wanted to sponsor me. And so I took the only job that was offered to me, which was in Perth. And so I moved from Sydney to Perth by myself to set that up. And that job was probably one of the best horror stories that I think people have heard when I tell them about some of it. And it sort of just kept getting worse. Like I after 3 years, I got to the point where I was like, it just has to be me. It has to be, like, I'm the problem. I must be the problem. And so I decided to take a break in the industry, and I worked in some other industries like retail and agriculture, and just did other stuff. Even did just housewifing for a while, which is a lot better than people react to it. I'm like, no, actually, it was pretty awesome. Like, I would highly recommend it. I think after leaving, I sort of, you know, reached out on Facebook that I decided to leave the industry. And what really surprised me was people who I graduated with sort of came out of the woodwork and were like, oh my God, you're so brave. I want to leave too, but I don't know where to go. And that just blew my mind, because I thought I was so alone. I thought it was my fault. So it was really interesting, I think, to see that I'm not alone. I'm not the only sort of one that's been like, what is this? This is not meeting my expectations. I need to leave. I need to do something else.
Yeah. It's when we graduated in Canada, the stats were the average number of time a new grad stays in their first job is 6 months, and the average number of time a vet stays in clinical practice is 5 years. So fact that you stayed for 3 years in your first job that was a bad job is, that's a commitment in itself.
Well, I didn't stay in the first one for 3 years. I stayed in the first one for 2 months.
Oh, good.
The second one was 2 years, and then the third one was 10 months. And the third one was just like, I can't even believe I did this again. Like, it was just, it just felt like I kept trying to analyze what I did wrong in the other jobs and kept looking for, like, how to better that situation the next ones.
Yeah.
And I just found myself in the same situation, and that's why I was like, it's got to be me. Like, mm-hmm. you know, literally the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. And so I was like, it's got to be me.
So what, when you went from job to job, what were the types of things that you looked for in the next job to try to fix the problem? Like, what was the main problem the first job that you tried to correct in the second, and so on?
Yeah, so my first job, I really enjoyed working with exotics. I found it really fascinating. I felt I had, like, just a knack for it. And so I took on an exotics position, and I sort of was promised a bunch of things, but none of it really came to fruition. And I thought maybe it was normal. And so, like, the first day I got there as a baby vet, I was sole charge for most of the day. Like, I had to call my boss back in to come give me the code to the safe so I can give my first emergency pain relief. You know, like, just things like that was like, is this normal? I don't know if this is normal. And so I put up, I think, with a lot more than I should have, just not having the experience. But I think it's sort of hard as well, because when I was working in the States, I was working at a specialty and emergency center. And so that was my expectation. And so because this wasn't a specialty and emergency center, it was sort of like, whoa, maybe this is normal for how little mom and pop clinics are run.
Yeah.
And so I really sort of just tried to compensate, you know, just tried to go with the flow of it. And I ended up leaving, because of, I just found out that the clinic had a really bad reputation. It was under investigation from the RSPCA and the Vet Surgeons Board, and it was kept getting worse. So to try to rectify that mistake of sort of only having one, I guess, pair of support, which was the boss, I thought I could work in industry. So I started focusing a lot more on applying to industry positions. And so I got a job as a vet in a laboratory that bred genetically modified mice for medical research. And honestly, it was awesome. I really loved that job. Like, it was really cool. I found it really fascinating. The whole animal research side is very greatly misunderstood, and it was just one of those things that I didn't see myself being, but I really liked it once I got there. I did leave because I didn't feel valued after a while. I think the company found, you know, an edge up in the industry, and so they sort of started to really push their staff to their limits, and so I was sort of trying to cover up the gap for that. And it just got to be too much, I think. And I had a bit of a cracked it a bit. I think I got very bruised when the CEO told me that a backpacker could do my job and that my whole degree was on YouTube. So it's kind of like, you know, now I'm going to write my resume, I'm done. But other than that, I really enjoyed the job.
It's crazy that finding, in an industry position.
Finding, like, a different... I just tried to get into a different industry, yeah. I guess. Like, I tried to get into a more supportive, like, corporate environment where I thought, I don't know, just having the different different style would rectify my mistake with the job.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy to hear that in an industry position, which is normally, you know, you don't have that excess crazy work because they normally have more regimented hours. I've talked to a few people working industry jobs, and that's interesting to hear that it's part of that world as well. So it, even in industry, it goes to show you job to job, boss to boss.
Yes.
It doesn't, just because you go into industry doesn't mean that it's going to be magical.
Yeah.
And I know you and I previously chatted about the "a backpacker could do your job" comment, which still makes my blood boil after chatting with you, 3 weeks ago. When I think about it, I still get angry. And it's you know, commenting on that as we chatted about. It's just such a stupid, ignorant thing to say, because you need to know what you don't know. And as a vet, you need to understand all of the diseases that you might be missing. Otherwise, you're really doing a lot of danger. If you have a dog that has a fever of unknown origin, you're like, oh, yeah, it's probably autoimmune. Give it antibiotics or give it steroids, and it turns out to be an infection. You can kill that animal. So not knowing what you don't know, and it's like to say that your degree's on Google, so much of what we learn isn't just the exact knowledge. And I had a situation personally where my finger blew up. So it just, I woke up one day, my finger was massively swollen, and of course I'm a klutz, so I thought, oh, I must have banged it. I'm trying to think, did a cat bite me? Like, I can't remember. Spent weeks before I went to the doctor. I saw three doctors before one was like, that's pathognomonic. And I had researched, I had looked on the internet, and being someone that grew up in a medical family that has a degree, I still couldn't find the right diagnosis on Google as a doctor. And it was that ignorance of what you don't know. I kept going down the road. I thought that I had a tumor in my bone that was blocking blood supply. Turns out I just have psoriatic arthritis, a dose of steroids, I was fine. But the reality is that there's so much, even when you are incredibly, you know, knowledgeable about how to interpret data, if you don't know what you don't know, then that's incredibly dangerous, and that's the value of the degree. So I'm just so angry at your boss for making this stupid comment. You can just find it on Google, because that's, you know, we hear that from clients all the time. Oh, I Googled it, I know it's this, and their animal comes in, you're like, your animal is yellow, it's not an ear infection. They're not eating because their ears sore, they're in liver failure, they're yellow, but people don't know how to Google, like, how to physically
It's like the degree has really, I think, helped in how to critically think.
Yes.
How to, you know, look at a situation and be like, is it a horse or is it a zebra? You know, like, there's very, and it, or it could be something completely random. You know, it's definitely critical thinking. It's definitely, like, your branching train of thought. And, out to that, it was just not valued. Like, that type of education was not valued.
When you went from being a nurse to the vet role, obviously that education was the difference between a nurse role and a vet role. Did you feel that you had much more knowledge as a vet than as a nurse? How did you feel that transition?
I guess with nursing, you're sort of, it's very, with nursing, it was sort of, you get into a routine. So, like, whenever emergencies come in, you know how to set up, you know how to intubate. Like, everything is a routine. You're not really thinking about what the final diagnosis is. You're relying on sort of the vet to do that call. But you're set up in that routine, I guess. You know how to behave. You know how to support the vet in what they're looking to do in their treatment plan. And transitioning to a vet role was relying on nurses to have that done, to have that support for you. But I think it's really easy that when you're so used to a routine as a nurse, it's really easy to sort of be like, oh, I've seen this before, this is this. But even though it's not, you know, it's very easy to, what's it called, when you've seen a similar type of case and you sort of triggers your brain to think that that's what the diagnosis is.
Yeah, like pattern recognition or availability.
Yeah, pattern recognition. That, I think, was much more myopic as a nurse. As a vet, you do have that pattern recognition, but you don't rule anything out. You still have the critical thinking of, like, all of the other possibilities as well. The main thing I noticed going from nursing to vet was I felt better treated as a nurse. I felt like my bosses treated me better, paid me better. I thought vets sort of treated me with more respect as a nurse than bosses treated me as a vet. Like, after I left working as a vet, I worked as a nurse. And I was like, this is great. I should have just stayed working as a nurse. This is so easy.
Yeah.
And it was so great. Like, I had clients come in that were, you know, all angry about something. They're like, I'm going to talk to a vet. I'm like, sure, honey, no worries. Like, I'll go get you the vet. It was great.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just a different kettle of fish, I guess. It's just a different perspective on the same, in the same industry.
Mm-hmm. So right there, you can see the difference of the value of your degree.
Yes.
Because you've lived through that. Oh, anyways. So when you went from your industry role, and then you went to another job, you said, for 10 months. So what did, was that another clinical role?
Yeah, so that was back into a clinical role. Because I just really missed it. I really missed, even though my first job was like an absolute nightmare, I really enjoyed working as a clinician. I really liked making the relationships with clients. I really liked the entire diagnostic system, the procedures. I just found everything fascinating, and I loved it when clients came back and like asked for me specifically, and or you know, brought me flowers or chocolate after I literally just killed their animal. Like, I should be sending them flowers, but they're giving it to me. Like, it's just that it was really cool to have that relationship with people, and I really miss that. That's not something I got in the industry. And so I went into a clinical position in a very affluent area, and it was just, it was sort of just more of the same of the clinical thing. It was, I mean, the red flag was probably, you know, we treat all of our staff like family, and then after a few months it's like, are you dysfunctional, toxic family? You should have warned me about this. You know, like, this wasn't, this is not how you made it seem.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I really miss the clinical aspect of it, and the work environment in clinics was pretty much the same. It was just not a functional work environment.
Were you able to interview at multiple places, or were you still in a situation at that point where with you were limited by who was willing to take you on as a visa? Like, did you have lots of options?
At that point, I was a permanent resident. And so I did have lots of options, but I guess I was looking for where I wanted to live. Like, my partner at the time was living with me, and we were sort of like, where do we want to settle down? And I didn't really like the city I was living in, like the area, so we were happy to move. So we moved 3 hours to go to this, like, clinical position, 3 hours away from where we were. And it just, yeah, it felt very isolated. Because they sort of had a monopoly on the area, they treated it like that as well. Like, they treated it very much like they had a monopoly. And it, I think it was more of, I just couldn't find, I wasn't really sure what I was expecting in terms of culture. So with, let's think, like with, your blog on what type of kick-ass fish are you would define this really, really well. It's sort of like, I'm going to go off on a bit of a tangent, I think, because it just explains it a bit better. But when I first graduated, because I had that nursing experience, I very much thought I was like a tuna, you know, mm-hmm. And so my first job, they actually wanted me to be a shark in a pond. And so it just was not going to work, you know, because I'm like, okay, but I'm a tuna, and you need to support me to be a shark. Like, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And my confidence is really so ruined by that first job that when I started the second job, I felt like a guppy. Mm-hmm. I felt like I just didn't know what I was doing anymore. Like, I wanted someone to hold my hand now. Like, I lost all my confidence.
Yeah.
And they were really good, and they did help me. They did really support me to get back to tuna, and then they really wanted me to be a shark, and then with the aspirations of being a whale, basically. Mm-hmm. So I got to sort of shark position in the ocean and was feeling pretty good, you know, that's why I got the confidence to leave. And then going to the third job, being used to being a shark, they expected me to be a guppy and to sort of just shut up and do as you're told, and that just wasn't going to work either, you know. So I think your analogies for that were perfect. Mm-hmm. That really, I think, helped me understand after the fact what environments I wasn't choosing.
Yeah.
Or what environments I should have been choosing for myself.
Yeah. I'm glad that helped. It's one of my favorite blogs, because I find a lot of people, like, you can't just put your finger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if you don't know exactly what's wrong, but you're feeling something weird, then maybe you need more or less. And I felt that in places where it's like, no, I need more, no, I need less. And it's something that isn't quite tangible as, you know, I don't like my schedule, I don't like that person. It's just a feeling, yeah. So it's hard to put it on. I'm glad you like that.
It was so good, and it really epitomizes how the expectations are not being met on both sides. I mean, you, like, going into a job, you have expectations, but then your boss also has expectations, and you guys have to meet somewhere. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't sort of have it one way or the other. It's a two-way street.
Did you talk with your boss when, well, first question, when you went into that, when you went into that job, did you do, you know, an interview? Is there anything that you think you could have done prior to that third job to let you know it wasn't the right fit beforehand? Or do you feel like they lied?
I actually did I did multiple interviews with that third job. I met with both of the business owners individually. I did a tour of the clinic. I talked to the nurses. I really tried to suss out if this was the environment that I wanted, because ultimately I didn't really care what I was getting paid, or I didn't care what how many hours I was working. I just wanted a healthy environment where I felt supported. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to necessarily, you know, I wasn't moving there for the money. Definitely wasn't moving there for the money. But I wanted to have, you know, that support and the interesting caseload and the ability to be the type of vet that I wanted to be. And I really thought I sussed it out quite nice, or quite well, I would say. But it's really difficult, because I think when people, especially clinic owners, know that they might have a problem, I think they do a very good job of compensating to hide certain problems. And it comes out later, once you've been working there for a while, that you're like, oh, so you actually do know this is a problem, but you just don't want to admit it yet.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, so some things were just very elegantly swept under the rug. And I guess naive. I just didn't notice. But I think I've gotten a lot better at that sort of sussing out clinics, because now I've gone to clinics and interviews where, you know, within 5 minutes talking to the nurses, no one's been there for more than a year, red flag. I'm like, no, don't want to do this. So I mean, I think it really needs to be made more readily, like, understood for our industry. What are red flags? What is a toxic work environment? What are your expectations? What are their expectations?
Yeah.
Because I think that just so gets lost in translation now. It's sort of treated like it's a vet job, what more do you want? But it's more complicated than that. There's more factors than that.
Yeah. And what you're saying too, I have students all the time saying, you know, I'm told I need good mentorship. What does that mean? I'm told my first job's important. What does that mean? I'm told to avoid a toxic environment. What does that mean? So trying to, you know, have these conversations so that new grads can look at this and be like, oh, that's a red flag. That's a red flag. I think is helpful. Did you talk to your boss when you were in that position to say, hey, you're treating me like a guppy, I want to be a tuna, I want to have more? Did you try to make it work in that position and they just weren't interested, or were you just kind of done at that point where you just had to leave?
It's sort of hard, because I think part of it's my fault. I didn't have the confidence to just stand up and be like, no, actually, I'm entitled to get pay slips every time you pay me, so give me my pay slips. At the same time, what I did have the confidence to do was like, well, why is it done this way? I've worked at places where they've done it this way and they had really good results. What are your results that you find? Like, I very much tried to approach things very delicately, I guess. Probably too delicately.
You have to start delicately, because the egos are so strong that I do that too when I go to places. Well, actually, you know, at this clinic they're doing it this way and maybe we can do that. Or the latest science is that they're doing it this way. Do you want to try it? To try to let them adopt your approach with saving face. But yeah, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
and they did not want to hear it because they've been doing this for 10 years and I've only, you know, I'm a new grad. So, and I mean, my first, and that was one thing I also didn't understand because I loved working, like, once I was a few years out, I loved working with the new grads because I'm like, what new stuff can you teach me? You know, like, we're only a few years away from each other, but what have you learned? You know, what's your newest take on this? Because medicine changes so quickly.
Yeah.
And my first boss that I worked with, I watched her put fluoroquinolone in a malassezia, otitis externa, that I know is malassezia because I did the swab. And so when I brought it up, her response literally was, I've been doing this for 25 years. And she was so angry with me that I even mentioned it.
Gosh.
And I was like, so you've been putting antibiotics on fungal infections for 25 years? I don't... What? Just, like, I couldn't deal. I was just like, I need to leave. Like, this isn't...
Yeah.
You know, just because you've done it this way does not mean it is good medicine. And that, I think that's just a big, it's just a big gap in trusting that someone might actually have a better answer.
Yeah.
Because it's just how you've done them.
One of the things I try to get people to do is a working interview and make sure that they have a disagreement with their boss in that. Push a case, get to a place where you disagree,
yes.
and see how they respond. I was doing an interview at one clinic.
That is such a good idea.
Oh, man. I was working at one clinic when I was in fourth year doing a rotation.
Yeah.
And I was like, Monday, Tuesday, I'm like, I'm totally going to work at this clinic. Like, they go running together, they go swimming together. Like, it's a little bit behind in medicine, but some of them seem pretty keen. They do a lot, really very caseload, busy, that kind of stuff. And then a C-section came in, and a planned C-section in a Shar Pei, and they were just going to gas it down. And at this point, this was Wednesday, and I had started to see some signs, so I just said to the boss, oh, like, why are you gassing it down? You know, it's probably the, you know, Alfaxan is out, and it's the newest drug. This was a year after Alfaxan came back to Canada. And I was like, really? Like, we should be using Alfax or even propofol, and it's much better for the puppies and use less ISO. And he literally took the bottle of propofol, threw it at me, threw it. Like, not like a nice toss. He was like, you do the anesthetic then. And so I was like, okay, fine. Like, I don't want this dog to die. You clearly have no idea what you're doing. And they couldn't get an IV catheter in, the, like, cooperative, awake, healthy dog. So then they just said, F it, and gassed it down anyways. And then they did the C-section with no IV access. And that was on Wednesday. By Friday, I left at noon because I couldn't take it anymore. I was crying at how poor the medicine was. And Monday and Tuesday, I was like, I'm going to take this job. Like, this is it. This is going to be the one.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to kind of have those conversations and push your boss to that critical point where you have a disagreement, whether it's about salary, hours, schedule, medicine, no matter what it is, just to see how they respond to you in that disagreement space to see if you can work with them. Because, like,
it
can take months to get
there.
It's crazy. Because, yeah, I've had, like, horror stories. It's nuts. So after that third job, why did you decide to leave clinical practice instead of looking for a different job? Where was your headspace at that point?
I guess I felt really, I'm not really sure. I knew I just needed a break. Like, I got burnt out. Like, I did. I got burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize I had burnt out until I was on an after-hours call by myself, and I had a euthanasia go really bad. And I realized after, because I was quite upset about it, you know, everyone hates those bad euthanasias. Like, I really prided myself on how I euthanize animals. Like, they always got a pre-med. They were always snoring happily in mom or dad's lap. I always did a butterfly and gave distance so that when they stopped breathing, sort of, I wasn't in the picture, you know, I wasn't up in their face. And I just tried to make everything as smooth as possible so that at the end, the owners were kind of like, that was really smooth, that was really nice, that was, it wasn't confronting, they didn't, you know, gasp and collapse, it wasn't a drama.
Yeah.
And this euthanasia just went really poorly, not necessarily because of what I was doing, but because of how the owner was behaving, and I didn't know how to empathize with her. I realized that this wasn't empathizing with her situation, and I was getting really frustrated. And I think the euthanasia went worse because I had just, like, lost that empathy, that ability to relate to her and what she was, like, what this owner was going through. And I sort of came away from that going, I need to leave this job because I've lost empathy for my clients.
Yeah.
And so luckily I was already, you know, the owners I was working with already shipped me off. So it wasn't like, oh, I'm burnt out. I need to leave a really good job. It was like, I'm burnt out and I need to leave this not great job.
And
things with the clinic started, which weren't being managed well. And I guess having that, recognizing that I was now burnt out, mm-hmm. made the decision so much easier. Being able to be like, okay, well, you're refusing to give me payslips that are accurate, and you're refusing to do this. And so it's not a loss, you know, like I can go somewhere else.
Yeah.
I think, though, that when you really want to do a good job, it's really hard to make someone else feel like they're not doing a good job. And so that's sort of where I felt stuck. I felt very stuck trying to make things better, because once you start to try to make things better, you have to admit that they're not good now. And a lot of people don't want to do that.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard, especially for those mom and pop business owners. There's so much emotion and ego, and
yes.
Not ego in a bad way, but, well, sometimes in a bad way, but even ego in a good way of it's their baby. It's what they built up, and to come in and point out and say, you know, really, you should be doing it this way. And then they just look at you like you're an idiot. They're like, oh, what are you, 10 years old? And it's so frustrating. It's like, well, even if I'm wrong, just listen, determine whether or not it's accurate with an open mind, and then either move forward or not. But there is just that huge wall to, like, make any change or listen to anyone else. Yeah. I find that very, very frustrating.
I think that's really important what you've said about there's a lot of emotion and ego in it. And I think that's so just on the money. That's perfect. That's exactly right. Like, ego and your emotions don't like being proved wrong. And so when you're really emotionally attached to something, you take it as, like, a personal insult being proved wrong. Whereas I personally love being proved wrong, because mm-hmm. that's how you learn.
Yeah.
You know? That's literally how you learn. So if you don't like people telling you that you're wrong, you're going to get stuck. You're going to get stuck, and you're not going to know that you're stuck, and you're going to all of a sudden find yourself one day that it's like you against the world, when in reality, you just have to sort of swallow your pride a little bit and recognize maybe the problem's you.
Yeah, you know? it's you against yourself, but, and then the world's on the outside looking and being like, what's up?
Yeah.
And you're like, it's you. You're like, no, just step out of that box you're in and join us. But they're just like, you put me in this box. It's like, there's the door, buddy. Join us whenever you like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're in there by yourself, man.
Oh, man. So at this stage, do you feel that there's anything that could draw you back into clinical practice, or are you just kind of done with that? What are you doing now? Like, what's your kind of plan, essentially, or lack of plan?
I don't know. I really don't know. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. I really have. And I think I failed when I got most of my, like, idea of what the industry should be like in the United States, because the U.S. is at least 20 years ahead of what Australia is. And so I probably set myself up for failure by coming to Australia in the first place. Not so much to get the degree. I think the degree prepared me really well, but more for not going back with the degree. Because clinics in Australia still sort of run like their retail shops. They don't run like their hospitals. And I think clients are recognizing that and they don't like it. And it's making you lose trust with your clients. And so I think I sort of, set myself up for failure probably with that one.
I think coming from a specialty
at the same
center.
Time.
Like the fact that you came from a specialty center in the States, which is
the
leading edge. You know, we have to admit, the States is the leading edge of that technology and progression, especially in veterinary medicine. And then going to a small clinic. And I think if you went to a specialty center in the state or in Australia, you might feel a little bit more at home. I agree. I still think they're not as up to date. For sure. Well, for sure they're not as up to date, which is a little bit hard for some Australians to hear and process. I get very upset when I say that. But I think because I've been working in the specialty centers and it's not as bad. Where when I hear the stories about the GPs and stuff, it's more like home as well. And I think those clinics do exist in North America. When you look at the mom and pops, some are really good, some are shockingly terrible. So I wonder if you would be happier in more of a specialty center that is trying to be more progressive and up to date.
Well, I wasn't really sure that I wanted to do like emergency and specialty medicine. I just wanted to practice good medicine. Yeah. The end, you know. And so that was what I really struggled with, because I feel like a lot of the smaller clinics, it was like, well, we've done something, so it's good enough. But it's just not. Not good enough. And you can definitely practice good medicine still using, you know, financial constrictions.
I agree. If you've got a lactate
meter first.
Like if you have a lactate meter, a glucometer, and those BUN sticks. Do you remember those little BUN sticks?
Yes.
Literally, you can do so much with just that.
Yeah.
Cost a client, you know, maybe $80. You charge $20 for each of those tests. QOTS, PCD total protein, blood glucose, BUN, lactate. And you can do so much just with that. And any clinic can have those things. And I think you can do amazing medicine in the clinics, but a lot of clinics don't want to necessarily take that step. I get that frustration. You have to manage a clinic or own a clinic to be able to enact change, but then I find there's a lot of walls that you hit, because if you're managing a clinic, it's probably one of the bigger companies, and then they put all these restrictions on what you're allowed to do. So it's frustrating.
Like what their standard of care is, yes.
Yeah. So you feel that just standard of care is not something you feel you can accomplish to your needs at this point?
I don't know. I've had good experiences at some clinics, like at Waves in Perth. I had a really good experience with them when my dog was sick. So, you know, they, as a pet owner, they have the tick of approval for me. And so I have had good experiences in Australia, but they're pretty few and far between.
Yeah.
And I think it really comes down to their perspective on how clinics are run. I mean, I thought it was really weird. When I started my first job, that it was like when you walked in, it was just shelves and shelves of stuff to buy.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was so weird being, you know, a clinic. You're acting like it's a retail space, and I would be really suspicious of like my dentist if I went to the dentist and they were trying to upsell me toothbrushes and, you know, special gum, and you know, like that would be kind of weird. And so I think people are just starting to lose trust in the industry because it's the business model is retail. It's not a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I'm not sure if it's the, I guess, overall view. That's just been my personal experience. To stay in the industry, I think what you said before about having new grads get a really good mentor, have one supportive boss. If I had had one supportive boss, that would have been great. That might have kept me in. Having a work environment that actually values staff, that doesn't treat them like they're cheap and replaceable, that would be great. I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. Because I don't know how much of it was my preconceived expectations.
Yeah.
And how much is the reality, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I think unless I had my own clinic and really put my money that I don't have where my mouth is and tried to make, you know, how I think a clinic should run, and unless I really had the data from running my own, I can't prove it's if it's the right way or the wrong way.
Yeah.
But it's, I guess, it did not meet my expectations,
mm-hmm.
the overall so far in Australia.
Yeah.
And I think given that, half of vets, if they're not vets after 5 years, I think that's a pretty obvious data set of saying, the industry's not meeting the expectations of vets. And that should be really, really scary, because the new generation of vets is also the new generation of pet owners. They're your best pet owners. If anything, you're not meeting their expectations. I think that's very scary to think about.
It's one of those things where you really, I think, need to go into a clinic here and say, this is the level of medicine I want to perform. Like you said, minimal stuff, you can do that. I think it is possible in some clinics to achieve that goal, but you have to have a receptive boss, and you have to have a very dominant personality where you can go in and say, I'm not tolerating anything less. This is what we're going to do. Can we get on board or can we not? And I think there are clinics out there that might be willing to do that. I work with in the Northern Beaches in Sydney, and there's some clinics that some GPs are doing phenomenal stuff. There's one clinic in particular that I think is absolutely great. Like the cases that we get from them are, they're complete, they're organized, they're up to date, they're everything.
That's awesome.
It's like if I were going to GP, they are where I would want to practice. And they're never hurting for staff in this crisis. And the Emerge Clinic where I work as well, never hurting for staff, because it's a supportive work environment that, supports its workers. So I think that if clinics got on board and created a more progressive environment and took these millennials, took these new grads that are coming out saying, I am not going to tolerate for low standards of medicine or I'm going to leave, then they could run and be so successful in this one clinic in particular. Like in this crisis, they never are hurting for staff. Everywhere else, can you work? I've never once had them be like, oh, we need someone to fill a shift. Can you fill a shift? Because they actually have a good work culture and good medicine.
That's awesome. So that's so good.
I'm hoping that as this kind of new generation of vets come through, more and more are standing up and saying, no, I'm not tolerating that. No, I'm not just giving antibiotics for that. You have to run the culture. I'm not just throwing steroids at this and letting it run away. We're going to do a skin scraping. So I'm hoping that in the next kind of 5 years or so, as the new grads are coming out and putting their foot down, that clinics are going to change. I don't know if that's being too hopeful.
They have that confidence.
Fingers crossed.
That definitely wasn't me.
Yeah. It takes a lot, and it takes a receptive boss. So it takes a very, very strong-willed person, and it takes a very receptive boss, and that's two hard things to find in this industry, because most of us are not confident. Most of us are afraid to stand up, and in a female-dominated industry, when you stand up for yourself and when you say things, you're looked at as bossy instead of, like you said, men are looked at as, oh, look at those leadership skills. I think that's such an interesting point.
That was definitely something I noticed, where I personally just did not have the confidence to say, no, I don't think that's good medicine. And I think even just that short, sweet, to the point sentence, I just didn't have the confidence to say that. I mean, now I do. Now I do, because I don't have a job writing on it, I think if the industry was more receptive to people saying, no, I want to do better, instead of, this is just how it is, suck it up, it'll keep the industry from totally collapsing, because I think that's where it's heading. I think it's genuinely... like you said, with the employment crisis, it's like it's collapsing, and everyone's sort of acting like everything's fine. We don't have a problem.
The attrition rate is 5%.
And I've talked to some.
The attrition rate is 5%. So we're losing 5% of the workforce every year. It's like it's more than we're graduating.
Yeah,
that's wonderful.
Guys, why do you think that is? come on.
Yeah.
We have graduation day, and then you have no longer being a vet. What's happened in between?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is they worked as a vet.
Yeah.
come on. We gotta figure this out, because it's just not... It's going to really affect the people who are left in the industry adversely.
Do you think if you could talk to yourself from 3 years ago, would you be in the same situation you're in now, or do you think that you would have a different story?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I think I really needed to have all these sort of bad experiences and really have my confidence broken in order to build it back up again. This probably sounds really sad, but I feel like I'm now a much more confident and better vet because I had people treat me like I wasn't good enough. And I think having those failures or having those perceived failures has made me have a completely different perspective. And I don't think I would be, you know, as passionate about the industry as I am now if I hadn't have had that. Because I think a lot of people, like I have friends who have left the industry and they've gone into human medicine or they've gone to law or they've just sort of completely checked out and they're like, no, I'm not part of this industry anymore. I don't want to be. And those people, we really need them to like advocate for change in the industry, not necessarily abandon it for something else.
Yeah.
So I think it's a hard question to answer, you know. There's always like, oh, if I had done things differently, you know. There was definitely a point where I was so resentful of getting the vet degree. Like, I couldn't believe I spent so much time and money on it, and it was like this worthless piece of paper, and I wanted to burn it because I felt gypped, like, so dramatic. But really, it's so valuable in that it's taught you other skills other than just how to be a vet. And I think advocating is one of those skills.
I was going to ask you, do you regret doing your degree? So overall, you're still happy that you did it? If you could go back in time, would you do it again? Or
there was definitely the time where I was mad about it.
Yeah.
But I think I really enjoyed vet school. I think I learned a lot about critical thinking and how to research medicine and analyzing data and what works, what doesn't work. And I learned how to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned how to fail. And I learned how to learn from failing. And that was, like, the best life skills that, you know, you can ask for. Like, I very much think that success is just failure plus time. You know, you need to fail in order to be good at something.
Yeah.
And so I think I do value the degree. I do think it was worth it in that sense, in teaching you to be a better human. but I don't see it as, I don't know, I guess I'm sort of at a point in my life now where I'm trying to think laterally, how can I still use this degree? How can I still use it? But using it in a completely different
mm-hmm.
way than the traditional clinician, I guess.
Yeah. Have you looked at other avenues, such as like doing other different types of industry roles, like, you know, like food or like drug reps, essentially, or teaching or things like that? Have you thought about that kind of sideways industry avenue? I know you had a bad experience with the research industry aspect.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I guess when I left the vet industry, very much was like, I need to do something different that's not animal related. I just have to see what else is out there because I feel like I sort of cornered myself and I felt stuck. So I worked in retail and I worked in like, I literally just like drove farming tractors out in Louisville and made more money than I did my first vet job, which is so weird. And so I just got totally different perspectives in different industries, and the retail really sparked this like fascination in me about marketing psychology, because I, on like my first week working in retail, sold a lot of, I was working in jewelry, and my bosses, every time I sold something, were like, yay, congratulations, and they popped the champagne, and it was like a big party, and I just found it so bizarre. I was like, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Why are you praising me for doing my job? And the culture was completely different, and the way you interacted with clients was totally different, because you had this item that they didn't necessarily value it, but if you use the right terminology and use the right energy, you could make them value it. And then it just got me really interested in human behavior and the whole psychology behind spending money. And once you sort of realize that, you know, humans are literally just like naked monkeys, that they behave in very predictable ways, it's actually quite interesting. And so the marketing psychology behind selling things to people, mm-hmm. I found really interesting and really sort of latched on to. And so I'm trying to bring that interest back into vet, and that's sort of why I very much think that, like, vet clinics running as a retail shop is not going to work, because people don't buy into what you do, they buy why you do it. Simon Sinek has a really good lecture on this. And
my husband
if people lose that why, if people lose that why, they can feel that vibe. They know. Like, clients aren't stupid. Mm-hmm. So I don't know yet what I'm really doing laterally with this degree, but I find the whole, sales psychology and marketing psychology of humans really interesting and mm-hmm. pretty entertaining.
Yeah.
And I mean, I would sell to people, like, if you think of jewelry, like, an engagement ring is like the most useless thing in the world, but because they're emotionally attached to it, you can sell it at a 3,000% markup, and people are like, oh my god, yes please, take my money. And, you know, like, compare that to vet care, compare that to a genuinely life-saving procedure, and it's just not marketed the same. You know, you've got to market it with an emotion, you've got to market it with a different approach than what's currently being done, and it's just fascinating. I think it's really interesting. So I'm trying to see how I can do something in the industry with that aspect. We'll see how far I get.
Obviously, you know, selling is a huge part of veterinary medicine, and the public have this perception that we oversell and we're in it for the money. So I think as a countermeasure to that, so many vets, especially new grads, go out being like, I'm not going to oversell. So we have this hesitation to do things. And I know you were telling me your story with your personal pet, where you knew it needed blood work, x-rays, you knew it needed these things, and the vet wasn't wanting to do them because she didn't want to waste your money. And it's, you know, I think selling is such a, it's the wrong term. Being honest about what animals need is the selling in vet med, but do you think that we are doing essentially a terrible job in that in the vet world? Do you think that going into clinics and talking to the staff and saying, this is how you get people to do what the patients need, I feel like that would be, you'd be great for that job. I think that's something.
Well, I guess, I don't know. I guess I was the type of vet who never pushed products or a treatment unless we did the tests to know that that was actually going to be helpful. So, I mean, for example, I worked at a clinic that just, like, we got yelled at if we didn't push enough worming tablets. And it was like, how do you even know these dogs have worms? Have you tested them? Like, you don't know. That's not, like, I bet you the number of clients who would absolutely love it if you said, oh, are you in to buy your worming tablet? Would you like us to check to see if you actually need to have a worming tablet? You know, you would just drop off this fecal sample, it costs this much money, blah, blah, blah. You go through, it takes this much time. If you took a photo of what the fecal sample looked like under the microscope and texted it to their phone and said, all clear, no worms, no need for a tablet, yay. Like, people would love that. People would absolutely love that because they're getting an experience. And guess what? You've made more money on doing that test than just pushing the worming tablet. And people just, I don't know why it's not done this way. Because you're, like, even though you're treating the patient, which is the dog, it's the human that's having the experience, and it's the human who needs to part with their money. Mm-hmm. And you need to give the owners an experience. That's what they're paying for. And so if you can keep your owners happy with a good experience, then you can treat the animals and do good medicine. You can practice good medicine.
I love that because we have larval tick season right now, and there's these, the dogs are just going absolutely haywire. I didn't even know these existed until coming to Australia. They go haywire. They're running around like crazy, and all you can see are these tiny little black dots on their skin. And so you just look at their dog, they're going nuts, you look at them for 2 seconds, and it's something that they can't see. You're like, oh, we need to do this treatment. And they're just like, what are you talking about? So what I do is I'm just like, hold on a second, grab it, put it under the microscope, zoom it in. I'm like, come look under the microscope with me. And I was like, that's the larval tick. And I show them, and they're like, oh my gosh, that's what that is. Or when you show them, when you print out a copy of the blood work and say, look, this is what we're doing, and these are the numbers, here's a copy for you to take home. Or when I, every time I do x-rays, I show them the x-rays. And I find so much of clients really want to see that, and it does. It gives them that value and that experience. Even when the x-rays are completely clear, I bring them back and say, look at this. So this is what we're looking for. And I'll pull up an example of an obstruction, and I'll pull up a normal dog. Or if there is abnormal, I'll Google normal dog x-ray. So they can see that I'm pulling it up from Google and be like, this is normal. This is your dog. This is the area we're worried about. And it's showing that value. I think we do a terrible job of showing value because, A, we're not confident in ourselves, so we're not valuing ourselves, but showing the value of the tests. We do a terrible job of that in veterinary medicine, and I think if we did a better job of that, then there would be way less of an issue in terms of the financial component. Because, like you said, people come in all the time. Oh, well, that surgery that's going to save my dog's life is expensive. Like, I have a wedding coming up, and I'm like, what is more important to you? Your wedding? Your flowers for your wedding that are going to cost like $5,000 and die the next day, or your dog's life? Like, I've been in consults where I'm just looking at people being like, really? Like, how about you just don't have the flowers? Be like, hey guys, I don't have a bouquet, but I'm carrying my dog's leash because it's still alive. Like, walk your dog down the aisle as your bouquet. Carry your little teacup poodle. Yeah, I don't care.
People love that. But the people love the experience. Like, this is why, you know, every little kid wants to be a vet, because it's that experience that really just resonates with humans for some reason.
Yeah.
And that is how you get to your clients, is by actually getting to them, you know? Giving them that experience.
Cool. So what are your, like you said, you're not quite sure where you're going to go at this point. Do you have any advice for other vets to, in terms of either, you know, stay in the profession, I wish I did it, or leave the profession, I'm glad I left, or advice to new grads, just general ideas that you wish you could tell every single vet that's graduating out there?
I guess if you're feeling burnt out and you feel like you need a break, just take a break, because it is so much better to learn how to take a break than to quit. Don't work to the point of exhaustion and you absolutely just hate what you're doing. Like, that's just not worth it. It's definitely scary leaving what you know and trying something you don't know, but I found that trying things that I never in a million years thought that I would be doing. Like, I'm 5'2" and 52 kilos, and I was driving like the massive huge seating tractors up in the week that, I had to climb up like on a ladder to get in the cockpit. And it was such a cool experience, because it was something that I would never see myself doing, and it looked hilarious because I looked like an infant in this tractor. And it gave me a totally different perspective, and sometimes you just need a change of perspective to really appreciate the first thing. And I really appreciate my time in retail. Like, I think my partner really didn't want me to go into retail because he was like, no, it's demeaning. You're, you know, a highly trained medical professional. Don't go work in retail. And it, you know, at the time, I just was like, I just want to sweep floors. I don't want to have to, you know, I just need something different. I can do anything different. And I really enjoyed my time, and I was really good at it. And so, yeah, if you're feeling burnt out, if you're feeling like you need to try something different, definitely do it, because it's worth it, even if you don't come back. And I guess as well, the advice for maybe new grads, it's find a supportive boss. Find someone who wants to learn from you just as much as you want to learn from them, because that relationship is what will build on in the clinic. And if you don't have that relationship, then you're just an employee and you'll be treated very, very differently. I don't know. I think those are probably my two big things. It's like, leave if you want to leave, and if you're going to stay, make sure you make good choices of who you stay for.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think if we have more people taking that advice in terms of, especially, you know, only stay if you're working for someone good, those clinics that have jerk bosses are going to fail.
Yeah.
They're not going to fill their shifts. They're not going to fill their clinics, and they're going to have to close. If people refuse to work in bad environments and only choose, especially now in this climate, there's 1,000 jobs for every vet.
Yes.
Only choose to work in an environment that's going to be supportive of what you need and supportive of the medicine that you want. I think that we can really shift the industry quite quickly if we can kind of get people just pushing for that. So hopefully.
Yeah, they're developing that sense of self-worth and knowing what you're worth as well. Because now I have the confidence to walk into an interview, you know, that offers you a ward wage, and you just be like, I literally made more money driving tractors out in the wheat belt, so you're going to have to do better than that. You know, like, having that confidence is just really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So, I hope more vets in our industry can develop that confidence.
Yeah. Good. Awesome. Well, I will let you go at this stage. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story. I know it's a lot to kind of put yourself out there, and it's scary to share these stories.
Oh, it's terrifying.
And it's scary when you feel that it's, you know, we all have that imposter syndrome. So I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your story. And I think it'll be really helpful for other people going through what you went through. And I think you have really good advice. And also, if you ever need help with your Instagram, contact us, and I'll contact Jessica. She will help you out. She is the reason for my new non-abrasive-looking Instagram. So thank you so much for all of your help. You've been a huge, huge help to me. And if anyone is starting up their own business, I think Jessica's a great person to talk to get advice. She knows a ton of information in our conversation that was kind of sporadic. I learned more than, you know, a year of trying to do on my own. So that was very helpful.
Thank you.
So thank you so much. And we will chat again soon.
Thanks, Anne. Speak soon.
Okay.